Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week I'm happy to say that we have Valerie Hebert on the show, and we'll be talking about her new book, Hitler's Generals on Trial, The Last War Crimes Tribunal at Nuremberg. War, of course, is a messy affair, and it's difficult to say that there are rules at all. In the course of the 19th and early 20th century, however, Europeans had worked out a system of conventions about the way that it should be prosecuted. You're probably familiar with the Hague Conventions, for example. Well, the Germans, when they prosecuted the war in Eastern Europe against Poland and the Soviet Union, manifestly did not follow these conventions. And so after the war, they were called to account for what they had done. This is really the subject of Valerie's book. The concept of war crimes itself is a new one, and it was just being tested out at the Nuremberg trials. And Valerie does a terrific job of discussing the various conundra and paradoxes and dilemmas that were faced by the people who were trying to bring the Wehrmacht generals to justice. She also does a good job of talking about the way in which they fought that war, really the horrible way in which they fought that war against the Soviet Union. So I really enjoyed talking to Valerie today, and I think that you'll enjoy the interview. So without further ado, here it is. Hi, Valerie.
Hi, Marshall. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good. I'm very well, thank you. I should tell our listeners that we have Valerie Hebert on the show today, and we'll be discussing her terrific new book, Hitler's Generals on Trial, The Last War Crimes Tribunal at Nuremberg. I should also say that this is the third book that we've done on the post-World War II war crimes trials. We had Hilary Earl on the show and Yuma Tatani, and they talked about, respectively, the Einsatzgruppen trial and then the trial of the Japanese generals. This book is about the trial, the subsequent military tribunal. Isn't that what it's called?
Yeah, they go by a few names, Nuremberg military tribunals or subsequent Nuremberg proceedings.
Yes, right.
A few incarnations.
Yeah, this one was of Wehrmacht generals. So
that's right.
And they had a number. How many of these subsequent military tribunals were there?
There were 12.
12,
and this was
yes.
The last.
Okay,
yeah.
This is the last. So we'll be having 12 people on the show, I think, eventually
right.
For all these military tribunals. I find them very interesting. They raise incredibly interesting questions about both the prosecution of World War II by the Japanese and the Germans, about victor's justice, and also about international law in general. And all of these questions are brought to light and answered in a wonderful way by Valerie. And I really look forward to talking to her about the book. But let's begin the interview, if you will, by having you say a few words about yourself.
Well, certainly. I was born and raised in Montreal, Quebec, Canada, for our international listeners. I went to McGill University for my undergraduate degree and master's degree, and focused right away on European history, German history in particular. My father had always been interested in the Second World War. And a lot of people, when they ask me sort of how I got to where I am now, you know, where did it all start? And I have to say, I can't ever remember a time not knowing who Hitler was or what the Second World War was about. It was a topic of conversation around our dinner table, commonly. Which isn't to say I always knew I would be a historian. I, in fact, had a fleeting interest in photography and thought that's really where my career would lay. And then after a disastrous interview with the Fine Arts Department Admitting Committee at Concordia University in Montreal, I decided, well, my backup plan was to do history at McGill. And I went along with that. And my first year as a student, the movie Schindler's List came out. And it was a real shock to me because I had, as I said, grown up feeling like I knew more than the average person about the Second World War and about the Holocaust. And the movie, for all its flaws, and some people have talked about those, but it, for me, it was a huge eye-opener and revealed to me, you know, just how vast and important this history was. And I decided then and there that I would make a career out of studying it. And so after McGill, I went on to the University of Toronto, and I worked with Michael Maris. He's an internationally renowned historian of the Holocaust. And I knew fairly early on, too, that I wanted to work on law and history and the ways in which these disciplines, I mean, they're both interested in the past and making sense of the past. And I was fascinated by the ways in which these two disciplines intersect and diverge in that pursuit.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And how did you come to write about the General's Trial specifically?
Largely fluke, actually, and I credit Hillary Earle with that. My original plan was to work on denazification trials. These were the series of trials that the occupation powers initiated to try and root out all remaining vestiges of Nazism in society. And I, you know, for one reason or another, I thought I wanted to work on those. And then it was in an early conversation. I was a new graduate student to the University of Toronto, and I was Hillary was a few years ahead of me in the program, and we were talking fairly casually about plans and research and that kind of thing. And I said, oh, well, I think I'm going to write on denazification. I said, oh, done to death, never mind. She said, you should work on the Field Marshal's case. And I was young and impressionable, I guess, and she seemed to know a lot more about these things than I did. And on the spot, I simply switched and in my head went, all right, I guess I'll do that. And started digging, and it was a very happy accident. I think I just stepped in the right puddle because it ended up revealing hugely fascinating questions for me, and I think has worked out well, has produced the stories, you know, far more interesting than I could have predicted at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that one thing I'd like you to talk a little bit about, and you know a lot about this, but I think that most of the listeners to this show, and certainly me prior to reading your book and a couple of other things that I had read before, didn't know, is that the trials of the Wehrmacht generals and other Wehrmacht officers after the Second World War and their incarceration, they were kind of hot topics in West Germany. And this is in addition to the general question about how the Wehrmacht conducted the war in the East. And I'm speaking specifically about a book that I read, and it was a long time, I don't know how long ago it was. I think it was called Keine Kameraden. Do you know this book?
No, it's not ringing the bell.
I thought it was called Keine Kameraden, but anyway, it's a German book about...
Of course. Yes, that's who's that? Not Christian Streit, but...
maybe it is, yes, Christian Streit. I don't know. Anyway,
It might be. It should be. Yeah,
I think it might be. And then there was this touring exhibition about Wehrmacht war crimes that was in
95,
exactly. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about the history of that question.
Well, that's it. And that's why this trial ended up being so interesting, because, you know, reading during my comps year, the comps year where you read in various fields to try and, you know, become an expert, I put in quotations, in these various historical fields, you know, one one question, I was interested in law. I was interested in the way, law and history sort of diverge in their representation of the past and the role that trials play in creating historical records. And there was a very influential book for me written by Lawrence Douglas. He's a legal scholar. And he wrote on several Holocaust-related trials and showing how each one, presented a fairly clear picture to their audience about, a certain aspect of this history. And these were, the first Nuremberg trial, the Eichmann trial. There were a series of trials in dealing with Holocaust denial in Canada. And I mean, it was, you see very clearly the connection between what went on in the courtroom and then the conversation in the public. But the question that left me with was, well, what happens when you have these trials that are interested in saying something to a wider audience that's more than just adjudicating the innocence or guilt of the person in the dock, but trials who have this purpose of saying something, to society at large? Well, what is it that ensures that connection is made?
Mm-hmm.
And it seemed very, obvious to me early on that there is nothing built into the mechanism of a trial to do that. And this became all the more apparent in this trial of army officers, because the mandate that went behind organizing the Nuremberg trials was about not just achieving a certain measure of justice, and justice, I think we have to think of more as sort of a symbolic level, that so few people were called to answer for these horrific and unprecedentedly huge crimes. Obviously there was a certain level of symbolism at play, but apart from justice, they also wanted these trials to educate the German public about the truth of their past, that they had lived under a Nazi dictatorship. They didn't have, fair, neutral, unbiased accounts of the news, and certainly, they had a certain resistance to admitting to the crimes that had been committed in their names, or that they had committed themselves, either through consent or direct participation. And so Nuremberg had this very heavy mandate to fulfill. It started with the International Tribunal, which is that first Nuremberg trial that most people know about, conducted jointly by the Americans, British, French, and Russians. But then the Americans wanted to continue this, not only because they had so many war crime suspects in their custody, but also to continue this mandate for education, because they hoped that through education there would be a greater chance for social rehabilitation, that Germany might be more fully converted to democracy. This might more assuredly establish peace, and peace, not just, again, for two generations like with the interwar period, but, much farther into the future, stabilize the continent, that kind of thing. So with the subsequent series of trials, these 12 trials, what they did with the American planners, they divided up the defendant, the accused, the suspects in their custody according to the institution they represented. So as Hillary Earle wrote about the SS Einsatzgruppen and these shooting squads, there was a trial of doctors who had conducted medical experiments in the camps, government ministers, the judiciary, judges who had enforced racial laws, that kind of thing, and then these military trials. And there were three trials dealing with the military. The one I studied, the High Command case, was the most comprehensive. It dealt with field commanders and staff officers throughout the entire, pre-war planning stages to the end of the war, and, everywhere that the war was fought was concerned with this trial. And more than any other trial, I argue, more than any other trial, it was the trial of the military that most had the potential to connect with the German public, because it was the military that represented the broadest sections of the ordinary German population, right? It was 20 million had served in the ranks of the military. And so if they were trying to say something about German responsibility for or complicity in crime, ideological crime, racial crime, then this was the trial to do it, the trial of SS, although these, concerned egregious, unprecedented crime, in terms of the ordinary person's observation of this trial, well, those were fanatical SS men. They were monsters. It doesn't surprise me that they did that, but we can wipe our hands. They are not us. We are not them. Same thing with, high government ministers or the, the heads of German industry. These were people remote in power and in the station. And so, really, when we talk about, fulfilling the didactic mandate of the trial. It's these military trials that come to the fore as having had the potential to fulfill it.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think, not to jump too far ahead, they fail. Just to put a word on it, they fail. And we'll come back to that in a second. But let's talk a little bit about the mechanics of the trial themselves. So they were run by Americans. The Americans had rounded up a lot of these people. How did they select whom they were going to prosecute in this particular trial, in the general's trial?
You know, it's a little bit of sort of a mixed bag. I mean, I had documents. They actually wanted more people on the dock. Some defendants, for example, Manstein, they were in British custody. And so, I mean, perhaps I should back up. Telford Taylor, who ended up sort of spearheading the subsequent proceedings, he had a very senior position at the International Tribunal under Robert Jackson, who led the prosecution there. Within his portfolio, Telford Taylor at the IMT, he led the case, the institutional case for the Wehrmacht. So individuals were indicted at the International Tribunal. Organizations were as well. And the Wehrmacht High Command was one of those organizations. And Telford Taylor was in charge of that case. And that case was failed. The tribunal did not find the High Command an organization. I mean, largely on technicality, but suffice it to say, Telford Taylor was very disappointed. He very early on recognized how important it was to place the crimes of the military on record and to speak about, you know, institutional responsibility as well as the responsibility of individuals. And so this was always a priority for him in the subsequent proceedings. And they had a number of individuals in their custody, but in the course of preparing the organization trial, the IMT, a lot of evidence had come to light, you know, implicating other generals who were still alive and in other custody, but they couldn't always get them. And sometimes this was a matter of, you know, why should we go to the expense of, you know, extraditing these men and trying them? Shouldn't the British, take their responsibility to prosecute them, because the law at the foundation of these trials was applied to all the occupation powers. They all had the mandate and the jurisdiction to prosecute these crimes. So the Americans, you know, part of it, their feeling was not Telford Taylor. He would have gladly taken them on, added them to the case, but of people around him was, well, let's just deal with the men we have in our custody. Mm-hmm. But there were mundane reasons as well. I remember reading some documents in the archives where they talk about, well, you know, we can't actually fit any more chairs in the dock. you know, so and this, you see this over and over again, and it's always sort of, an important reminder to us as historians when we read these things that, you know, at the end of the day, these are still people dealing with, you know, practical limitations in planning these, you know, what end up being internationally significant proceedings. And yet there's still things like, do we have enough paper? Do we have enough pens? Are we going to have people enough warm bodies to staff these things? And so as much as it was a matter of sort of international you know, politics between, you know, British and American, why should we do the British, you know, job? It was also very mundane concerns as well.
Yeah, well, one of the reasons I ask is that there are some big names, I believe, who survived the war missing here, and I was thinking of Manstein. He's one. Guderian is another that's he doesn't get tried. And then and then Jodl, I don't know if he survived the war or not. I don't think Brauchitsch
did. He was tried in the first one.
Oh,
first
was he?
Nuremberg.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah. But anyway, there are a lot of people, you know, if you follow World War II sort of history, there are a lot of people that are not here. And a lot of the names are totally unfamiliar, at least they were for me, and I was kind of surprised about that.
For me as well. And, you know, having come from a background trained in World War II, and I sort of thought, like, who are these people? It was a surprise for me as well. And yet, when you start, you know, digging, you realize the level of authority and command that they enjoyed.
Uh-huh. I see. So there was no intention here to try everyone who possibly could have been convicted. This was simply a selection for a didactic purpose. Is that
it
right?
It was.
Yeah.
It was. I mean, it wasn't arbitrary entirely.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I mean, they had to be in custody or locatable. And, you know, if they were in another occupation zone, they didn't, in the end, want to make, you know, effort to bring them out. But, No, and I mean, that's a tension you see running through the trial as a whole, this idea that, you know, these are 14, ultimately 13 individuals. It's their criminality that we are trying to decide here. At the same time, they couldn't get away from the fact that, well, we are saying things about the institution as a whole and things that will be, we hope, impressed upon German society as a whole. But you see this over and over again, that in some respects, the individual identity of the defendant seems to recede in importance, and it's what's being said about the institution as a whole that that really has the most to say in terms of the trial's didactic value.
How did the Americans meet the objection that this kind of trial of military men in the prosecution of a war was without precedent, and that more generally one might easily say, well, this was, in fact, a military conflict, and in military conflicts, these kinds of things often happen. And prior to this moment, no one had ever been held responsible for this sort of thing in World War I or the American Civil War, or the Crimean War, or the Napoleonic Wars. There had never been a prosecution of military officers for these kinds of things. How did they meet that objection?
A number of ways. I mean, they were very quick to resort to certain, I mean, this was international law in its infancy. You know, there wasn't, you know, a long, jurisprudential history for them to draw on. I mean, they were, at the same time, it wasn't entirely absent either. They had things like the Hague Convention and the Geneva Conventions that regulated, conduct in war, treatment of civilians, POWs, that kind of thing, that they could draw on, and that the Germans themselves were signatories to, and they said, well, you agree to this. There were international treaties, like the Locarno Treaty, Kellogg-Briand Pact, things that had declared war sort of, beyond in terms of, what was acceptable in solving political problems or political differences. Well, war was sort of placed beyond, any measure of resort. And so, they were able to point to certain elements existing either in customary international law or, declared formalized treaties, conventions, that kind of thing. And so, I mean, there was some foundation to build on. But what you see over and over again is we can't not respond to this. And what we are confronted with in this war when it comes to, the civilian loss of life and, the unprecedented brutality and cruelty with which POWs, Soviet POWs were treated. I mean, this requires some kind of response, and one can't help but recognize that this is criminal. And it didn't necessarily, because it was motivated by Nazi ideology. I mean, it's criminal because it's still murder and abuse and neglect, and these officers had a duty as professionals to extend their protection to these people, for many reasons. So it was like, the international law cries out for a statement about this, that sort of in our guts we recognize this is criminal. This is the opportunity to make it so. And, this idea that, all wars are terrible and terrible things happen in all wars. There's certainly, and this was an issue that came up in the Americans' other series of trials, the army trials held at Dachau, and where, one case in particular, the Malmedy trial, where it was an SS contingent murdered a bunch of American soldiers in Belgium. And they said, isn't this just sort of, heat of the moment? This was one case where it just seemed like, we can find analogous cases of Americans murdering Germans or, so there are instances where you can say, well, yes, the Americans were not blameless. They were not absolutely, they did not conduct the war, without any, overstepping of these bounds. They, the Soviets as well. I mean, the Soviets also were brutal in their treatment of German prisoners of war, but the scale is different. And when one also takes into account the reasons behind these, and this is where, when I said before that they weren't convicted for being Nazis, and they weren't Nazis in any formal sense. They weren't members of the party or anything. At the same time, when one looks at the array of crimes, at the identity of the victims, and at the numbers of victims, one can't help but recognize that these crimes were committed in pursuit of these ideological, racial, political aims. And so I think that was that required a response, and that goes far beyond battle frenzy or heat of the moment. That, you know, these things were premeditated, and that's, you know, the trial spent had such a heavy reliance on the criminal orders that were, and policies that were decided upon and put in place far in advance of the actual hostilities, to show that these were not simply a byproduct of war and a sort of an unavoidable but albeit awful consequence of war, that these were intentional results. And, you know, that's where the criminality, and that's what requires the judicial response.
One of the things that interests me, though, is that while I agree with you from my perspective, it does require a response. I'm wondering whether that's just not an American perspective, because the British didn't seem to think so. Did they?
No, but, you know, the British, there's a long history with the British. They had tried after the First World War to prosecute, to indict, and they had hoped for international trials of German war criminals of the First World War. And they were, you know, although there were a number of countries willing to join in these efforts, they were very quickly sort of left on their own, and it was, they were left holding the bag and doing this, and had a very weak position to actually press these demands, and eventually had to concede to the German demand to hold these trials themselves. And the trials were a farce, and you know, the very few convicts that resulted from these proceedings were, you know, escaped, I put in quotation marks, from prison, and, you know, practically given parades. Mm-hmm. And so the British had a very bad taste in their mouth about trials. You know, they thought, in the planning stages, they were very reluctant, very slow to come around to this idea.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not as if I shouldn't, if I recall correctly, it's not as if they didn't believe that some justice should be meted out. I think Churchill, for example, simply wanted to shoot the lot of them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, why are we bothering with all this trial? Why not, you know, political decision, it's over and done with, we can get on with things, on with, you know, restoring the peace and rebuilding our countries. And perhaps, too, that reflects, you know, the Americans, I mean, they didn't, they weren't bombed, you know, they weren't an occupied country. You know, it might have been far easier for them to say, well, you know, let's spend a little more time in dealing with this, because they didn't have the same level of reconstruction to deal with on their own territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on just a little bit. What were the Wehrmacht generals charged with specifically?
It's a long list.
If you could give us an abbreviated version of it.
Yeah,
that would be great.
The four main counts, you know, the Nuremberg, as Nuremberg defined, sort of summarized Nazi crime, was the crimes against peace, crimes of aggressive war, as opposed to defensive war, war crimes and crimes against humanity. At the first trial, these things were separated. In the trial that I studied, these were grouped and then divided according to whether the targets of these crimes were civilians or belligerents. So these included things like the murder, ill treatment of prisoners of war, reprisals against partisans, suspected or, you know, actual partisans, measures designed to terrorize and intimidate civilian populations in the course of occupation, things like the Night and Fog Decree, where suspected resistors or dissenters would simply be taken out of their homes in the, you know, the dark of night in order to terrorize their family, you know, never to be heard from again. Draconian hostage reprisal policies if a German soldier was injured or killed, you know, in an act of sabotage, or, you know, if their materiel was damaged, you know, 50, 100 civilians per German would simply be rounded up from the community and executed. And it, you know, in the orders themselves, you know, they say things like, these should be community leaders, these should be, you know, so that the rest of the society notices and understands and is terrorized in order to increase the terrorizing effect. You actually see this kind of language in the orders. Of course, I'm not going by order of importance, but the Wehrmacht's involvement in supporting or participating in the murder of Jews. You know, people, I think in the public imagination, you think Holocaust, you think gas chambers at Auschwitz and trains, but the first stage, we can say, of the Holocaust were, as Hilary Earle writes about, were these massive open-air shootings that SS shooting squads followed the army in to the east as it acquired territory, rounding up, behind the lines, rounding up, not just Jewish civilians, but all, you know, anybody deemed an enemy of the state, whether they're communist or, you know, or Jewish or what have you, and round, you know, shot them en masse. And so, you know, all the orders around that formalized the army's relationship and support of participation in these actions. Mm-hmm. There was also, things will come to me, I mean, there's so many more. Oh, the army's support for the slave labor mm-hmm. System. The Reich exploited the labor of conquered territories, you know, Jewish but also non-Jewish Slav, for example. And the army, you know, played a pivotal role in gathering up these people and, you know, shipping them off to whichever destination where they would serve as slave labor. I mean, that's just a sampling of the crimes against belligerents and civilians. Most of these crimes took place in the east, I should say, although the crimes did cover, you know, the entire geography of the war. The army's most brutal and horrific conduct happened in the east, and this has to do with the ideology behind the war in the east. This was, you know, defined as, described as a clash of two civilizations. It was a war to destroy, not just to conquer, but to destroy Bolshevism and to create in the east a new German nation where the Slavs, you know, those that survived would simply serve as slave labor mm-hmm. to increase, you know, the prosperity of you know, German colonizers to the east. This was very different from their approach in the west. I mean, for Hitler, Germany's future always lay in the east. He had to fight the west or by necessity, and even, you know, just in order to free himself up to conquer the east. So most of these crimes took place on territories in the east.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want you to talk about a couple of documents, actually, and their genesis, because you can actually learn a lot about the way in which the pretext under which the Germans conducted this war of destruction in the East by, I think, looking at these documents. And the two documents I had in mind are the Commissar Order. And then the second one that I want you to talk about a little bit is and I wasn't really familiar with this one, I'm surprised, the Barbarossa Justification Order.
Barbarossa Jurisdiction Order?
Jurisdiction Order, yes, that's it. Jurisdiction Order, yes, that's right. I don't know what order you want to talk about those, but they're very curious documents. And also they were redacted a little bit by the generals themselves, or by Brauchitsch, or I can't remember exactly who got his hands on them. But maybe you could talk a little bit about their genesis and what they said.
Right, well, I can start with the Commissar Order. The Commissar Order ended up being sort of a cornerstone of the whole trial because it was so unambiguously criminal. You know, in deciding whether these orders were criminal or not and whether the defendant should be held guilty for having implemented them, the principle that sort of emerged and came to be applied, sort of the deciding principle, was this what was called the manifest illegality principle. So in terms of, you know, armies are structured on a chain of command. And so, you know, these, as senior as they were in rank, they said, well, these were still orders that we received and we were duty-bound to enforce them. And, this, you know, it was a principle within the German Penal Code itself that if an order is illegal on its face, no one is required to carry it out. In fact, you are, you know, you can be punished if you do. If it's, you know, so clearly illegal on its face, you're under no obligation to obey it. And the Commissar Order was a perfect example of that. So the Commissars were those members of the Red Army, the Soviet Army, who essentially acted as political, ideological morale keepers for their comrades. So they, you know, schooled them in communist Soviet doctrine, you know, even, you know, during battle. At the same time, they were soldiers themselves. They wore the uniform, they carried weapons, they fought at the front in the same way as any regular soldier would. But when, you know, as I just described, when the Nazis were, when Hitler and, you know, other officials of the regime were planning the war, I mean, this, from the beginning, Hitler's, he wanted to crush Bolshevism. This was seen as the threat to Germany, and you know, the Jews were sort of part and parcel of that, assumed to be, you know, intimately connected, inextricably connected with that ideology. And so, you know, this desire to destroy Bolshevism manifested itself in many ways. I mean, you know, very simply initiating the war with the Soviet Union, but then also in the way it was prosecuted. And so the Commissar is an example of that. So the idea was, as Soviet prisoners would come into German custody, these commissars were to be identified and liquidated immediately, either by the army itself. More at the beginning, the idea is that they would then be, you know, identified to other police groups, SS groups operating, you know, within the same area of command, area of operation, and they would dispose of them. But, you know, you would see example after example where the army simply did it themselves. But, you know, this was clearly criminal, and yet one found it enforced over and over again in the defendants' areas of command. But it was one order that it was so clearly illegal that it was sort of an open and shut case. If they could find that this order had passed through, you know, such and such a defendant's hands, and then that, you know, field reports confirmed the execution of the order, well, that was clearly a crime.
Mm-hmm. And now, if I could just ask you to pause right there before we talk about the Barbarossa jurisdiction order.
Sure.
What office, I guess, in the High Command issued the Commissar order? What is its genesis, and who actually touched it and redacted it?
It came from Walter Varlamov, who was, you know, second or third away from him, a very senior staff officer in the High Command. Worked closely with Jodl, closely with Keitel. So this was the important connection that the trial was seeking to make, and sort of, you know, telling the story of, you know, how and why's of the Wehrmacht's responsibility for Nazi crime was, you know, Hitler had these ideas, you know, these goals, these ideas, and yet it was people like Varlamov that actually translated these ideas and these goals into orders that could be passed down the chain and executed on the ground level. Mm-hmm. So he was one of the key defendants in the trial. It was him.
Mm-hmm. When the order came down, how did the officers of the Wehrmacht respond to it? Do we have any evidence of that? Do we know what they said about it?
We do. And I mean, some of it has to be taken with a grain of salt. I mean, some of them said, this is clearly criminal. This is criminal, you know. And yet, some of them, we have to assume, went along with it, you know, depending on their own ideological sympathies. But, you know, there were some that say, of course, this is, I won't enforce this. I won't, you know. And yet we find field reports over and over, all over the place, where it actually was enforced. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to negotiate those two realities. That, you know, they have, you know, they claim condemnation of it. In some places, you don't find, you know, in certain areas it wasn't enforced. And yet, well, I guess that was one case where he did hold the line. That was a line he wouldn't cross. But in other cases, one finds it was. I don't think we can generalize.
But just to be clear about what the tribunal itself was expecting, they would have anticipated that somebody acting according to the old rules, so to say, of military conduct, would have simply stepped up and said, I refuse to conduct myself in a way that is in accordance with this order. I refuse this order because it is illegal. And right. Do you know anyone who did that?
Wilhelm von Leib springs to mind. He was, the case is named for him. He was the highest ranking defendant, and yet he was convicted of the least things. And they actually said at the end, you know, they never could find a single criminal order that had his signature. He seemed never to have, of all of them, endorsed a single criminal order. And I'm, you know, it's funny how these defendants, they run together in my mind now. But something's telling me it was he was one where they could never prove that he had, required that this order be obeyed.
Right. But the tribunal was expecting more. They were expecting people to resign their commissions over this. That's how someone could have been exonerated. Just to resign your commission and saying, I'm sorry, I can't fulfill this order. I'm done.
I don't know if they would have expected that. I think they certainly took the time to say, this is what you should have done.
Yeah. So that's what I mean, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what
yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, they did. And I mean, there's a section of the judgment where they said, you know, you have betrayed your own profession of arms by having lent your signature to this.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, even if, you know, you could not have changed the outcome, you know, that, you know, the machinery was bigger than you, the regime, the institution was bigger than you, you still had the power to withhold your consent, and you didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And this was seen as particularly damaging.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in terms of the law, but, you know, as a statement about their sort of, you know, ethics and overall conduct.
Mm-hmm. No, I see. So let's talk about the Barbarossa jurisdiction order now. This one is less well known. What is its genesis and what did it say?
The Barbarossa jurisdiction order, again, this was originated, you know, staff offices in Berlin, and the idea was to try and come up with means to combat the partisan movement. So, you know, the war was fought between, you know, members of both armies, Soviet army and German army, but civilians also took up arms against German forces and did so in great number, and unsurprisingly so, given the ferocity with which the Germans treated civilians and conquered the East. What this order did, and again, it came through Varlamov, I think also Lehman, he was another officer in the legal department. He also had a hand in writing it. The order, it's called the Barbarossa Jurisdiction Order. Operation Barbarossa was the code name for the invasion of the Soviet Union. Barbarossa Jurisdiction Order, because basically what it did was it allowed for the, you know, it extended the jurisdiction, sort of the power of military personnel on the ground in the East that suspected partisans or real partisans did not have to be put through sort of the traditional legal channels in order for their activities to be proven, because it was a point of international law that these, you know, illegal partisans, you know, not recognized belligerents, could be killed in reprisal, right? They could be killed for these actions. That was permitted. But upon, you know, proof of their activities and so on. So the Barbarossa jurisdiction removed that condition. And so on the, you know, decision of, you know, an order of this, an officer of this rank and higher, you know, suspects could simply be killed outright. It also removed from the German army the obligation to prosecute their own personnel, German personnel, who committed crimes against civilians. Mm-hmm. In practice, the order had the effect of unleashing you know, the fury on civilian populations, that people could be killed, you know, on the slightest pretext, and you know, in sort of proving this order and how widespread its application was. There's field reports that cite, you know, teenagers stealing bed sheets, you know, were named partisans and executed, that, you know, a woman sort of looked askew at a German officer and was shot, a family was accused of providing schnapps to partisans and they were killed, you know, father, mother, children. And so what one saw in practice was it seemed to sort of give cover to murders based on, you know, racial and political motivations.
Mm-hmm.
Protected those who did those, carried out those crimes from prosecution from within their own ranks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just to be very specific, I guess what it says is that if what had been called excesses of some sort were committed against civilians,
right, there was no obligation.
There was no obligation to prosecute anybody.
Right. Right.
What did the officer corps say about this? Did anybody object to this order? Or did they think of it as, you know, they think of it as something just wonderful because it freed their hands actually to fight these partisans or whomever they were fighting?
Well, again, it's sort of a mixed bag. I mean, you see some people, you know, they sort of take the argument where, you know, if we are only going to encourage, you know, perpetuate partisan activity by treating civilians like this because, you know, they have nothing. They now have nothing to lose, so why shouldn't they? But again, it's sort of more from a self-serving perspective that, you know, we only are further endangering our people by inflaming partisan, you know, sympathies, that kind of thing. You know, do you see anyone sort of welcoming it with open arms? I can't think of any instance where it did. That's one sort of the frustrating thing about reading this trial, and I think, you know, perhaps it's been, you know, influenced by watching, you know, Law and Order on TV, where you have these, you know, moments of confession and breakthrough, mm-hmm. and, you know, high drama in the courtroom. And what was, you know, endlessly frustrating to me is reading these transcripts was these men, and they'd be confronted with, you know, insurmountable evidence of, you know, egregious crimes, terrible atrocities, and yet still maintain this almost, you know, neutrality that, well, I knew about this order, but I certainly never allowed it to be carried out in my area of command. And, you know, my concern was always the discipline of my troops. Why would I allow them to, you know, run roughshod over? This would have been counterproductive to my, you know, resorting to these kinds of excuses without ever really addressing the moral issue at the core of them.
Yeah.
And so it's very hard to get a sense of how they felt about them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it was a trial. They were on trial and you know, perhaps still thought that they were on trial for their lives. I mean, beyond the first trial at Nuremberg, no military man was executed by the Americans for, you know, whatever crime. But, you know, at that moment, they might have still thought this was a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to remember that that's in their minds when they're defending themselves. And so, of course, they would say anything to deny any connection to it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what arguments did they use to defend themselves?
Oh,
I know there are a lot of them, but again, if you could summarize sort of the basic arguments.
I mean, you couldn't have I mean, sort of speaking to the prosecution, you weren't in the East. You didn't you can't possibly understand how awful it was. And, you know, different conditions required different conduct, and, you know, who are you to sit in judgment of us?
Mm-hmm.
There was the, especially with regard to the Soviets, did it as well. You know, the Soviets tortured POWs, the Soviets killed POWs, the Soviets, you know, and so tit for tat, you know, mm-hmm. ignoring the chronology of things that, in fact, well, yeah, but you started all these policies first, mm-hmm. and these were in place far, you know, ahead of the actual outbreak of hostilities. This was never acknowledged.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that, well, you know, absolute denial. I didn't know about that. I didn't know the Einsatzgruppen were shooting Jews. I didn't know that Soviets were dying, you know, at a rate of 80% in the camps in my area of command. I didn't know that these people would be, you know, if I sent these people to Auschwitz, that they would be killed there. You know, denial to a level that just, you know, boggles the mind. Also, they quit the evidence. They said, you know, in fact, I did. I did protest this order, but I couldn't make that protest public. I couldn't make a record of that protest because then I might be punished. Or I falsified evidence. So when they were confronted, you know, these reports that, so, you know, this many commissars were killed, you know, at this time in this area where you were. Well, that was a falsification. We invented that report in order to convince our superiors that we were carrying out the orders, which we, of course, recognized were criminal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right. So, I mean, it was weak. We were beholden to our superiors. We could not disobey these orders. On the other hand, we did disobey these orders, but we just couldn't make a record of it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, I knew about this, but I, you know, I announced the order, but then, and there's a, you know, written record of that, but privately to my officers, I said, yes, we won't carry that order out, but I didn't make a record of that. And
mm-hmm.
then there's what order? I never heard of that order.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the same person would make these, you know, mutually exclusive claims mm-hmm. over the course of the trial. And so it wasn't nearly as, it wasn't at all coherent or internally consistent.
Mm-hmm. So the tribunal itself, one of the things I was interested to learn in your book, showed a certain amount of subtlety in rendering judgment against these people.
They did.
They didn't just sort of throw them all out or put them all up against the wall.
No,
they actually seemed
to
have thought
didn't.
Deeply about these things.
They did. They truly, truly did. And, I, you know, a credit to them, really, because I think it would have been very easy, given the mountains of evidence and sort of, you know, the whole, you can just sort of say the entire East was awash in criminality and atrocity. But They said no. I mean, they and I think they took very seriously the fact that, you know, these trials, as much as they were designed to adjudicate the criminality of these individuals, these trials would have an afterlife. And, you know, being at the beginning of, you know, the formalization of international criminal law as we know it now, they wanted this trial to, you know, stand the test of time, to be something that could be looked at as a precedent. And so they were very exacting in their demands about evidence in you know, one could not infer criminality just because, you know, crime was occurring all around this one particular mm-hmm. defendant. That didn't necessarily mean he himself was also criminal. They looked for direct connection between the defendant and, you know, whichever crime they were deciding about, or identifiable moments of omission. Mm-hmm. Where, you know, this person had a duty to intervene against this and did not, and we can, you know, sort of give a time and place. And so, and even, you know, something like the Barbarossa jurisdiction order, which, you know, someone like you or I reading it would just think, oh, good God, I mean, there's absolutely no way this can't, you know, but be criminal. And yet this, well, in fact, when you look at, you know, the laws around treating partisans and things, you know, the law is still hazy on this, that there is a certain degree within the law that allows for reprisals of partisans. And so they said, well, so we can't, you know, outright declare this order as criminal. It's more its application. If, you know, this defendant introduced this order into the chain of command and then did nothing to constrain it, to, you know, apply it within reason, within reasonable limits, then we can say he acted criminally. Mm-hmm. But simply to have passed this order on was not in and of itself, as much as reprehensible as it might have been, as, you know, as much as it sort of opens the door to potential abuses, that in and of itself, we cannot say with certainty was criminal. And so, you know, I think, too, and I mean, you know, people say, oh, Nuremberg, you know, victor's justice, and sort of dismiss it. Well, I mean, this comes from not having read the record, because when you look at the differences between the prosecution's case, the scope of their case, the, you know, the amount of evidence they wished to put on record versus what the tribunal actually decided and confirmed, it's often a very much more constrained, much more complex and nuanced examination analysis.
So what sorts of penalties were meted out?
Prison sentences. Mm-hmm. Two defendants were acquitted outright. There were representatives. The Wehrmacht refers to all branches of the armed forces, the Navy, the military, and the Army, and the Air Force. The trial really, in practice, was about the behavior of the Army, the conduct of the Army. But they did have representatives, one of the Air Force, one of the Navy. But the trial, it always struck me that they were there more for show, more just to sort of round out the picture of this is a trial of the Wehrmacht. But the cases against them were always far weaker and didn't have the same prominence as the cases against other defendants. So they were acquitted. For the rest of them, the sentences ranged from time already served. Von Leib, who I mentioned before, he was only ever found guilty of having passed on the Barbarossa jurisdiction order without safeguarding against its exploitation or its abuse. Right, mm-hmm. But no other order was found to be able to be attached to him. So he was released with time served. The other ones ranged, you know, from a few years to life in prison. As it turned out, all of them had served much shorter terms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I wanted to ask about that, actually. One of the things that, again, I found fascinating in your book was the amount of sympathy that these gentlemen had within the German populace, and the fact that people in that population mounted successful campaigns to get them basically released early.
Right.
Maybe
right.
You could tell that story very briefly.
Well, I mean... The officer corps was a revered institution, and it was an institution that preceded Hitler. I mean, the officer corps always enjoyed a great amount of prestige and respect within German society. So there was a certain loyalty that persisted even after the Second World War among the population towards these men. But more importantly, it was sort of the political complications wrought by the Cold War that ended up undoing all the work of the Heikkinen case. And what I mean by that is, as much as the Americans sort of set themselves this agenda of punishing, you know, these representatives of the Nazi state and pressing the lessons of these trials home to the German public, sort of acting as, you know, the executor of Allied justice and, you know, a punisher of these representatives, they also had to tread lightly, because they very quickly realized, as soon as the East-West tensions mounted, that they needed West Germany to be on their side, to support the defense of the West, and not just, you know, the continent, but sort of in a larger sense. And Adenauer, the chancellor of West Germany, recognized, you know, this is a political opportunity. You know, now you need us. And so from very early on, he said, you know, if you expect us to rebuild our military, you can't also continue to hold our officers in prison. And then used this very explicitly, you know, if you want our cooperation, Western defense plans, if down the line you want a German army, it's a West German army, as a, you know, a distinct, you know, institution. There were talks early on about simply integrating German forces in a supranational army, but this went back and forth. But very explicit, you know, we will not stand for the continued, as they said, you know, debasement of our armed forces. I mean, and again, it goes down to never having accepted the judgment of the trial, never accepting the fact that, yes, the Wehrmacht did not just participate in crimes that we can now see were, you know, political or racial motivation, but actually we can identify they agreed with the ideology itself, mm-hmm. right? That they were instrumental in not just planning this, but in carrying it out. They never did accept that such a large segment of their population was involved in these kinds of crimes and to that degree. And so, you know, they could more forcefully, you know, so it just it carried up, and they wouldn't accept the continued imprisonment of their. Mm-hmm. Of their, you know, representatives of the institution. And so they used this, the Americans' desire to have West German military support in order to pry these convicts loose from their custody.
Mm-hmm. I see. So we said early on in the interview that the didactic purpose of the trials was not achieved. What sort of impression developed of the Wehrmacht activity in the East after the war among the German cognoscenti? What did they think about the Wehrmacht and the crimes in the East?
Well, that, you know, they conducted themselves in a way that was no worse than any other participant in the war, that the Soviets were just as bad, if not worse, that alternatively that the Wehrmacht was a victim of Hitler, that had, you know, their values of honor and loyalty and patriotism had been perverted and exploited by Hitler, and that they, you know, sort of co-opted into this conflict. But, you know, we did not fight for Hitler's Germany. We were fighting for the Germany of history and for the Germany, you know, that preceded Hitler, and it was their national duty to do so, even under Hitler's command, in order to preserve Germany as a nation. But, you know, it all gets summed up in this, you know, the myth of the clean hands of the Wehrmacht, this idea that, you know, they conducted, it was the SS that committed crimes, it was these other state, you know, police organizations and things that committed crimes against civilians, against Jews, but the army fought the war like any other professional army does and deserves no, you know, particular condemnation or criticism for its participation and conduct in the war. And this, I mean, this really was the general line, to the extent that it was even discussed at all. There were moments, I mean, it was started with German historians. They started publishing in the 1960s, about a generation after, where they, you know, things like about the Commissar Order, the one of the key pieces of evidence in the Auschwitz trial, which was mid-60s in Frankfurt, was a report on the Commissar Order. Right, and so we started to see glimpses where, you know, historians making this connection between Nazi ideology and the actual prosecution of the war and Wehrmacht behavior. But it really was a discussion among scholars, among the general public. They clung tenaciously to this idea that the, you know, the unblemished Wehrmacht, that our sons, our fathers, our brothers, our uncles, our husbands had no part of these awful crimes. And it wasn't until the mid-1990s when a research institute in Hamburg mounted a public exhibition, an exhibition designed to travel around German Austria documenting the crimes of the army in the East, that this exploded in the public forum. I mean, radio, the press, the German parliament started confronting these issues again, and what started off, I mean, in some places it was sort of a quiet, a sad sort of contemplation of these things. In other places, the reaction was violent. I mean, there was the exhibition site was firebombed in Saarbrücken. There were, you know, loud protests in Munich and Dresden, that kind of thing. But over time, it's sort of this, you know, this anger and rage over this, how dare you besmirch the good name of the Wehrmacht? How dare you impugn the memory of my father, who, you know, only was drafted in this war, had no choice in the matter, and fought it honorably as any other soldier would. This sort of gave way to it. I mean, the weight of evidence was simply too great to ignore. And I think enough time had passed that, you know, the people bearing the brunt of that acceptance or recognition were far enough removed that they could do that with a smaller degree of sort of personal, personal conflict, personal investment.
Mm-hmm. What? Let me ask a quick question. I doubt that you can answer this, but just in case, what are German school children taught about this?
That's a very good question. I can't say that I do know exactly. I mean, they've been, you know, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, that, you know, you have this perpetually, you know, this ongoing refusal to admit, you know, the broad-based participation in crime, and I mean, the, you know, the participation of the army, because it's the army that represents the largest segment of the population. So, you know, this persists right up, you know, from the time of the trial right up until the 1990s, and yet, starting, you know, after 1968, so, you know, the protests, you know, that generation that sort of comes of age and starts questioning its parents, you know, what did you do in the war? And these, you know, these discussions start to happen about the Holocaust and about, you know, crimes against other quote-unquote racial political enemies. Mm-hmm. You know, this stuff starts to come out. I mean, the German admission of responsibility, Willy Brandt kneeling at the Warsaw Ghetto Memorial in contrition, you know, paying reparations to Israel. So, I mean, these things were all, they were taught in school. School children would go on field trips to, you know, concentration camp memorial sites, these kinds of things. And yet it doesn't necessarily connect with justice or with, you know, you know, there were crimes but not criminals, that kind of thing. You know, since the 1990s has this, you know, curriculum also, I mean, so as much as, you know, the Holocaust and things started to be, you know, taught very openly in the schools, whether after the 1990s controversy over the exhibition, if, you know, the role of Wehrmacht was also added to this curriculum, I don't actually know. That would be a really interesting thing to investigate. But, you know, I would imagine it sort of falls in with the general literature. I mean, it seems like this is now something that has, this myth has, is something that has been overcome and sort of progressed behind it, and there's a better alignment between scholarship and public imagination, the public understanding of these events.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to the question either. I did think it was kind of interesting as well. Well, Valerie, you've taken up a lot of your time, and I really appreciate it. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Let me ask you our traditional final question on New Books in History, and that is, what are you working on now?
What I'm working on now is building on my work on Nuremberg, and again, getting at this question of the social utility of trials, but then applying that question to the Rwandan context. So looking at, you know, the Rwanda has taken on, you know, various different legal mechanisms in order to work through their own experience of genocide, but there's the formal, you know, traditional court process. You know, we'd all be familiar with national courts, but more important for my purposes, they've initiated the system of Gacaca tribunals. This is drawing on an indigenous ritual for community healing, where people come together as a community, hear testimony from victims, from witnesses, and from perpetrators, and then decide as a community on punishment. And it seems to me, you know, Gacaca and Nuremberg, they offer such striking differences in an approach to, you know, a traumatic history, that, you know, whereas Nuremberg was sort of the formal, you know, judges in robes and trained legal counsel and defendant's box and sort of trying to fit in with, you know, formal, familiar legal traditions, But then absolutely failing to connect in a meaningful way with the community that they were intended to serve. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, at the other end of the spectrum, these Gacaca tribunals, which are still interested in punishment, but by doing this sort of from a more grassroots, you know, less formalized approach. And mm-hmm. so my next book is looking at sort of trying to figure out if there is a model that better serves, community interests, societies that are trying to recover from traumatic past, if the law still has anything to offer us in helping us recover from those experiences.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project, and I wish you luck on it. Let me say thank you again for being on the show. We've been talking to Valerie Haber about her book, Hitler's Generals on Trial, The Last War Crimes Tribunal at Nuremberg. Valerie, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you very, very much. It was my pleasure.
Absolutely my pleasure, too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Valerie Haber about her new book, Hitler's Generals on Trial, The Last War Crimes Tribunal at Nuremberg. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.